The Masters and Nanny Elsa joined them in the dining room, which had been hastily cleared after supper. Grey velvet curtains were drawn across the tall windows, and lamps hung on silver chains above the long narrow table. Presiding over the room was a magnificent portrait of the Imperial family, purchased at great expense from an artist in Morgenholm, who swore it was painted from life. The cook had whipped up a platter of cold meat pies, pickled fish, cheeses and fruit, plus a bowl of salted eel soup for Randall. Those who'd already eaten sipped wine or brandy and picked at sweet biscuits.
"Your business in the East went well, I trust?"
Master Fasson inquired of Randall.
"Not particularly," said Randall, fishing out a chunk of slippery white eel.
Master Oric watched him through a cloud of cheroot smoke and looked slightly nauseous. Crodens had always found the Ossian love of eels repulsive, which Aaron privately thought a little unfair, since one of their own delicacies included boiled bull's testicles.
"Was it the grey cloaks?" Aaron asked.
"Ha!" said Master Oric. "Grey cloaks. They call themselves resistance fighters, but they're nothing more than a rabble of disorganized thugs. Don't even have a uniform. How do you know who's on your side if you don't have a uniform?"
"I doubt they even exist," said Master Fasson. "A secret underground network? I say it's wishful thinking on the part of those who'd see us gone."
His brows gathered together.
"Though Salt Fork is somewhat concerning, I will allow. These rebels grow bold."
Randall wiped his mouth and sat back. His face was all angles, hard and spare of flesh, but it softened when he smiled, and he smiled often. Aaron had inherited his dominant nose and wide jaw, but his gentle eyes and fuller mouth came from his mother.
"Grey cloaks or not, they were rebels of some stripe. My poor luck that we were close to Salt Fork when the trouble hit. I'd found an opportunity, some land I thought would make for good vineyards. We were coming to a deal when Salt Fork was seized, trade snarled up and the army came through. There was no business to be done with anyone after that."
"But you were so late returning."
Aaron tried not to make it sound like a complaint, but it came out like one. He couldn't help it. It wasn't his place to question his father, but he was disappointed that there had been no letter, no word of explanation until now.
"My travel permit only allows me to use certain routes, and in avoiding the chaos around Salt Fork, we strayed too far and fell foul of a particularly diligent official."
Kern stopped eating pies and cheese for long enough to give a snort of disgust. Aaron noted he avoided the fruit like it was poison. He was a squat, shaggy man, dark-haired and weather-beaten, who hunkered jealously over his food as if defending it from potential thieves. Randall gave him a faint smile.
"This particular paragon of efficiency kept us locked up until we could send word to the right people and get ourselves released."
"They locked you up?"
Aaron was appalled. Now he felt guilty for mentioning it. No wonder there had been no letter. Randall shrugged.
"He was just doing his job, I suppose."
"Scribes and clerics," Kern grunted. "That's what's wrong with the world now. Time was you could ride from Ossia to the lowland coast and you didn't need a bit of paper to do it. Once, arguments were won with blades and bravery. Now it's who tells the finest lies in a courtroom. Used to be a man's oath was enough for truth, but honour's long gone and we put contracts in its place."
"Here now," said Master Oric, "you Brunlanders needed some organisation. You barely knew how to lay a decent road before we came."
Randall slapped a hand on Kern's shoulder, intercepting him before he could rise to it.
"Forgive my friend, Master Oric," he said. "It's the curse of Brunlanders to speak plainly."
"True," said Kern resentfully. "We never did learn the trick of keeping our mouths shut so as not to discomfit our masters."
There was an awkward silence in which Randall gave Kern a hard stare. The Brunlander held it as long as he dared, then looked down at his plate.
"Anyway," said Randall, once satisfied that his authority had been asserted, "Salt Fork is over, the rebellion put down. Let us be glad of that."
Aaron was glad of it, indeed. It had made him uneasy to see the suppressed excitement on the faces of his countrymen when they spoke of Salt Fork and the Greycloaks. Their appetite for treason angered him. But he saw now that he need not have worried. It was an empty dream they entertained. They wished for revolution, but they weren't willing to inconvenience themselves to get it. They wanted someone else to shed the blood for them.
"Tell me what I've missed," said Randall, in an effort to restart the conversation and restore some levity to the room.
"Aaron just beat Master Fasten at Castles," Nanny Elsa said, with a mischievous glance at Aaron.
"Is that so?" Randall cried, delighted. "And I thought the old twig was unbeatable."
Master Fasten bristled and smoothed his sideburns with his knuckles. "Old twig," he muttered.
"How did you do it?" Randall asked Aaron.
"I owe the victory to Master Oric, actually," said Aaron. Master Oric looked up from his brandy glass in surprise. "To overcome your enemy, you must first understand him."
"Ah, yes," said Master Oric, though he still seemed bewildered to be getting the credit. "That's so."
"A strange idea to teach a boy learning the sword," said Master Fasten, "when his only goal is to spear the object of his attention with a length of polished steel."
His tone made it clear what he thought of the fighting arts.
"Not at all," said Master Oric. "If you see only the enemy, you do not see the man. People are more than just enemies and friends, opponents and allies."
"Does he hate you?"
"Then he may reach too far, swing too hard." "Does he fight to defend his family?" "Then he may be careful or desperate." "Does he seek death or fear it?" "Know his heart, and your blade will find it all the easier."
"I presume you didn't beat Master Fasten by stabbing him through the heart, though," Randall said to Aaron. "That would be a cheap victory."
"I should think he didn't," Master Fasten spluttered. He was beginning to feel picked on, and it was hard on his dignity. "Master Fasten scorns the weak mind and despises the lazy and inattentive," Aaron explained. "I threw the last three games to persuade him I was both." He knew he shouldn't go on, but he was unable to resist. Eventually it made him lazy and inattentive himself.
"Well, that's too much," Master Fasten exclaimed, red-faced.
Randall roared with laughter. Master Oric choked on his cheroot, and even Nanny Elsa had to hide a smile.
"You've got your mother's gift," Randall told him. "She could see right through people, knew what made them tick. One look at someone and she had them figured out."
"Would that he applied half so much craft to his studies," grumbled Master Fasten.
While they'd been talking, a servant had slipped into the hall to stand by Randall's chair. Now he leaned down and whispered in Randall's ear.
"Of course. Send them in," said Randall.
The servant motioned to the doorway, where the cook and one of his boys were lurking. They came to stand before the table, beneath the portrait of the imperial family. The boy, a mop-haired youth with a large brown birthmark on his cheek, looked nervous.
"Apologies for interrupting," said the cook, "but the boy has something I think you'll want to hear. Tell him what you told me, Mott."
"I've been to town for bacon," Mott blurted. "I was in the square, and a rider comes thundering in, all done up in fancy livery. Says he's an imperial messenger. Says they've been sent far and wide to announce the good news."
He stopped breathlessly, anxiously awaiting a reaction. The cook clipped him round the ear.
"Which is?"
Mott's face cleared as he realised he hadn't actually told them the good news yet.
"He says there's to be a royal marriage. Prince Otico is marrying Princess Sorrel of Harrow less than 5 months hence, on the last day of Copperleaf, Deathus,"
he added, belatedly remembering to use Croden months instead of Ossian.
"Hurrah!" cried Master Oric, surging from his seat. "I'll drink to that."
He held his brandy glass aloft, waiting for the others to join him. Nanny Elsa clapped her hands.
"What wonderful news," she declared. "And that ain't all," Mott went on. "As his wedding gift, Prince Otico's to be made Lord Protector of Ossia. The Emperor's given him the Ember Blade. 30 years it's been gone, but the Ember Blade's coming back to Ossia."
Aaron straightened in his chair. All his life, He'd scoffed at the tales and superstitions that surrounded the Ember Blade, yet the thought of it still rang some distant chord in his soul. That sword was the symbol of Ossia itself. He couldn't help but feel its significance.
"Has it been 30 years? Randall asked faintly.
His eyes were distant. The news had struck him as it had his son.
"Yes, yes, you're right. 30 years since Queen Alessandra fell. How the years have flown."
30 years, said Kern grimly. "And now the Ember Blade comes back in the hands of a Croden."
"That's enough, Kern," said Randall. He sounded weary and sad. "That's enough." He got to his feet. Master Oryk was still standing with his glass held aloft, arm trembling, unable to drink or to sit down without a humiliating loss of face. Randall raised his goblet. It was the signal for the others to rise and do the same, all but Kern, who remained resolutely seated.
"To the royal marriage," Randall said, and they drank.
Master Oryk gulped his brandy down with obvious relief.
"Now, you'll have to excuse me. I'm tired from the ride, and a hot bath is calling."
They said their goodbyes, and he walked from the room, ruffling Aaron's hair distractedly as he passed. Aaron watched him go, a concerned frown on his face. Master Oryk poured another slug of brandy into his glass and raised it again, tottering only a little as he did so.
"To the health of our good Prince Otico," he slurred.
"Oh, sit down, man," snapped Master Fasten.
8. After his bath, Randall retreated to his study and his papers. Aaron went to find him there, bearing a tray with 2 crystal glasses and a silver jug of golden sweet wine. He entered quietly so as not to disturb his father's thoughts. The study was full of cosy shadows cast by candles and wall-mounted lamps. Unshuttered windows let in the sea breeze. Thin curtains stirred beside a desk piled with documents. There were shelves containing maps and records, and a few valuable hide-bound tomes, and on one wall hung the symbol of the Sanctorum in brass and gold, a downward-facing sword resting across an open book, its pages like wings to either side of the blade. Randall sat in a wooden armchair of Croden design, its high, straight back decorated with bold symmetrical rays. He was leaning forwards with his elbows resting on his knees and his hands clasped, staring intently into the darkness of an unlit hearth. Several letters lay open on a side table. Aaron watched him from the doorway. Perhaps it was the vacant chair at his side or his pensive manner, but his father cut a haunted figure tonight. Randall had still not noticed him, which Aaron thought strange. It was normally all too easy to break his concentration, and the servants knew to be stealthy when he was working. He showed no sign of stirring, so Aaron walked across the study, carrying the tray before him.
"Father, I brought you..."
Randall jerked violently at the sound of his voice, then lunged out of his seat towards Aaron, fear and hate in his eyes. Aaron went rigid with shock. Halfway to his feet, Randall checked his attack. Aaron saw recognition dawn on him, and his face crumpled as he sank back in his seat. Aaron's gaze switched to the letter knife in his left hand, which he'd snatched up to plunge into his son.
"Father?"
Aaron said tremulously. He was still holding the tray level. The dainty crystal glasses had wobbled but not tipped. Randall pinched the bridge of his nose and closed his eyes.
"Forgive me," he said. "You startled me."
Aaron's mind was blank. For an instant, he'd seen a cornered man, mad and desperate. Now his father looked weary beyond his years.
"I brought some sweet wine," Aaron said, dully. "It's amberline."
"Thank you," said Randall.
Aaron placed the tray on the table and retreated in confusion, but Randall caught his arm in a gentle grip.
"Sit with me a while, my son," he said.
We've been long apart, and I've missed you."
Randall's voice calmed him a little. There was the man he knew. Still wary, he drew up another chair as Randall poured the wine.
"Who did you think I was?" Aaron asked.
The words came out unbidden, but he had to know. Randall gave him a wry smile.
"Perhaps I thought you were the Hollow Man."
He handed one glass to Aaron.
"You remember him, don't you?"
Aaron remembered him well. It was difficult to forget the nightmares he'd suffered as a young boy on the Hollow Man's account. But that was just a tale to scare children, and it angered him that his father would try to palm him off with such fictions. He took a glass and stared at it resentfully. Randall saw it and sighed.
"I don't know who I thought you were," he said. "For a moment you seemed an enemy. A robber, perhaps. I am more tired than I thought."
Aaron was reluctantly content with that. He glanced down at the letters on the table and wondered if they were the cause of his father's upsetting behaviour, but inquiring into his private mail would be to pry too far. Randall raised his glass in salute and they sipped. The complex, delicate taste of amberline flowed over Aaron's tongue, now sweet and nutty, now creamy, now sharp. Randall let out a breath of satisfaction, and Aaron relaxed a little more.
"There truly is no wine like amberline," said Randall, admiring the contents of his glass in the lamplight. "One thing our people can still sing about."
He looked over at Aaron.
"Soon you'll be the one travelling, eh? Your military service."
"I'm ready for it, father," Aaron said.
Randall chuckled.
"I've no doubt you are. Master Oryk tells me you've been working hard, and that what you lack in natural talent you make up for in persistence. Your other tutors tell me the same. They say there's no student more dogged than you."
"You're being kind, father. I know what they say. I try my best, but the lessons don't seem to stick."
"Well, I know that pain," he said. "I was the same. No boy was beaten more often than I."
He grinned, and Aaron grinned back, warmed by the wine.
"I gave up on my schooling, chose the life of the blade instead. Likely I'd have died of it if I hadn't inherited our family's lands. Not you, though. You keep going. You force yourself onwards, no matter how unpleasant the task."
"There is no great honour in working hard for what you want," Aaron said modestly, deflecting the praise as Croden etiquette dictated. "The Primus teaches us that. Diligence and persistence bring all things to a man."
"So they say," Randall replied,
but his smile became strained and fell away.
"Would that the world were as simple as priests see it."
"Father," Aaron hesitated, afraid to ask the question, afraid of an answer he wouldn't like. "The wedding, I saw how it affected you. Aren't you glad?"
"Glad enough," said Randall. "It's a canny match. Our nervous neighbours to the north have a formidable army and grave concerns that they might be the next country swallowed up by the Third Empire. A match between the last two royal families on the continent will stabilise the region and present a united front against Dern. They executed their own royal family not 10 years past, and neither Harrow nor Croder want anyone getting any ideas."
"But?" Aaron prompted.
"Ah, my son. 55 years I've been alive, you know. I've lived longer with Crodans as our rulers than without. But for 25 years I had the freedom to go where I pleased. The Nine held sway over this land, and we all spoke Ossian and nothing else. I saw the reigns of 2 queens and a king in that time, but only ever 1 ember blade. A sword of rarest embryum that showed red like fire in the rays of the sun. You know they named it Embrya after the ember blade. Did they teach you that in school?"
"They did, father,"
It's more than a sword. There's something of the divine in it. We believed it was a sign of approval from Joha himself. Every Ossian ruler since the reclamation had it in hand when they took the throne, and whoever held it was meant to rule. Even in our darkest days, when we had tyrant kings or weak ones or mad, even then, people believed that the Ember Blade would find its way to the right hands, guided by the will of the Aspects. We didn't know it, I think, but all our faith was in that sword. Our dreams for what we might one day become as a people. It was the last piece of the old empire that wasn't crumbling, or forgotten, or dead. Aaron had never heard his father speak this way before. He'd always been guarded when discussing the past, careful not to say anything unfavourable towards the Croton regime. The passion and longing in his voice made Aaron uneasy, but they also made him understand. "And now it returns to Ossia in the hands of a Croton," Aaron said, echoing Kern's words at the dinner table.
"We've lived well these 30 years," said Randall. "Life has been good under the Crotons, but it's still hard news to bear. I'd thought it locked in some dusty vault or on display in the Emperor's palace in Falcon's Reach, far from here. I'd thought never to hear of it again."
"Perhaps," Aaron ventured, "perhaps it has found its way into the right hands. After all the turmoil of the Age of Kings, perhaps this is the stability Ossia desires. Perhaps Prince Otico is meant to rule."
"Huh." Randall's laugh was humorless. "If the Nine really guide its destiny, I doubt they'd place it in Croton hands. Not while the Sanctorum starves their temples of funds, arrests their druids, makes mock of their teachings, and all but outlaws them entirely."
"Father," Aaron warned, this was getting too close to sedition.
Randall held up a hand in apology. "Forgive me," he said. "I suppose the old gods are no easier to cast aside than the Ember Blade was, much as we might try. We learn the world in our youth, and believe that is how things are. To unlearn it, well, I wonder if we ever really do, and sometimes if we should."
"What happened, Father, when the Crotons invaded? Did you fight them?"
"I did," he said, bowing his head. "We all did for a time, until the Ember Blade was lost."
"And then?"
"Then I compromised," he said. "It was that or die." He looked across the table. "Do you recall the day you came to me and asked me to take on Master Fasten? You said you needed extra lessons to keep up with the other boys."
"I recall. I was 10. I had just been shamed by Master Clun in front of the whole class. I was supposed to recite the Lay of Valan Sar, but when I stood up to speak, the words disappeared from my mind." Randall nodded, as if to himself, and said nothing for a time. Aaron wondered if that was the end of the conversation. Then Randall stirred, leaned over the side table, and laid a hand on Aaron's.
"I never told you how proud I was of you that day," he said. "I don't tell you enough. You're all that is good in me, all I have left of your mother. Whenever I think of the choices I've made, the things I've done, I think of you, and I know I took the right path. For had I done otherwise, I would not have such a very fine son."
The unexpected praise took him off guard, and Aaron felt his eyes prickle with the threat of tears. But there were shadows in his father's words. They thrummed with secret meaning. What choices? What had he done? He wanted to ask, but wasn't sure he dared. Randall took his hand back.
"I am sorry," he said. "I am not myself tonight. Let's breakfast together in the morning. I promise you a new man, then."
"Of course," said Aaron. He put down his glass, which he'd hardly touched, and awkwardly got to his feet, not knowing if he was relieved or disappointed. By the time he reached the door,
His father was staring into the empty fireplace again.
"Father," he said.
"Hmm?
Is everything all right?"
Randall turned his face towards Aaron and smiled wanly. For the first time in his life, Aaron saw the lie in his father's eyes.
"Everything is all right," he said. "Hail to the Emperor."
9. The house creaked and ticked like a living thing in the deep of the night. Aaron stepped out into the shadowy blue quiet of the corridor and eased his bedroom door closed behind him. The servants were mostly abed, but Aaron was far from sleep. He slipped along the corridor in his socks, carrying his boots under one arm, alert to every sound. If all went well, no one would ever know he'd gone, but if caught, he'd be punished. It was the one rule his father was very strict about. He had to be back home every night, and he wasn't allowed out after dusk. It galled him to be treated like a child. Other boys his age were allowed to run free till late. Randall was usually understanding and reasonable, but in this matter he wouldn't be swayed, and Aaron had never been given a convincing reason why. Well, he was a young man now, a boy no longer, and there were more important things than following another man's rules, even his father's. The lamps were still burning in Randall's study, yellow light leaking beneath the door. He passed by silently. His father's strange behaviour had filled him with unease, curdling his excitement about the night ahead. But that was something to worry about later. Right now, he had to escape. His hand went to his pocket, touching the brass key there. It was a key to the servants' door, copied from one he'd stolen from the maid. He'd bribed the locksmith's apprentice to make him a duplicate and returned the original before its absence was noticed. It had given him pangs of guilt for days afterwards. Petty theft and deception were not the acts of an honourable person. But then Cade reminded him that the heroes in his stories were always stealing swords or magic rings or maidens, and they were still counted as heroes. That made Aaron feel better. Sometimes it was necessary to do something ignoble in pursuit of a noble goal. Down the stairs he went, and through the moonlit parlour. The castle's board had been cleared away, and the room returned to order, but the stale smoke of Master Oryk's cheroots lingered. The low murmur of voices came to him from nearby. He pressed himself to the wall and peered through the doorway into the corridor beyond. The ostler and the steward were walking away from him, talking quietly by the light of the candles they carried. He waited for them to move out of sight, then nipped into the corridor, where he came face to face with Nanny Elsa. Both of them jumped, each as surprised as the other. She was wearing her nightgown and was standing in the doorway of the buttery holding a scone drenched in honey. For an absurd moment, Aaron considered running for it. Nothing could be allowed to prevent his escape. He opened his mouth to make some excuse, but Nanny Elsa raised a quick finger to her lips. It dawned on Aaron that she was carrying no candle. She'd been sneaking around in the dark as well. "I did not see you," she whispered with a smile, "if you did not see me." Aaron grinned. "Enjoy the show," she said, then slid past him like a spectre and was gone. Aaron gave silent thanks to the Primus for the luck that brought him a governess like Nanny Elsa. She remembered what it was to be young. Staying out late on the first night of the ghost tide was virtually a rite of passage in Shoal Point. Aaron had always been frustrated in the past, but he wouldn't be tonight. He reached the servant's door and let himself out, then locked it behind him, slipped on his boots and scampered across the grounds. The curtains of the house were mostly drawn, but he didn't feel safe until he'd passed out of sight of the windows and was well away down the lane. There he stopped and took a moment to exult. He let the cool wind from the sea blow across his face and listened to the trees stir and the animals rustling in the grass. The lane was bathed with calm, steely light, and the freedom of the world was his. He heard a low, mournful groan from beyond the cliffs, like a giant of old stirring in its sleep. In reply came an eerie, far-off whistling cry that conjured a vision of some spectral eagle flown out of the shadowlands. The ghost tide was here. Spurred by the sound, he hurried on. The route he chose took him parallel to the cliffs, but he was careful not to get too near the edge. He didn't want to see the sea until the moment was right. Instead, he followed the brambled lanes that wound through fields and sloping pastures. The sisters were close in the sky tonight. There was pale, bruised Lissa, bright and smooth, brushed with streaks of pastel blue, green and pink. Nearby was baleful Tantera, black and swollen, riven with glowing red cracks. The Hangman stood stationed in the west, outshining the neighbouring constellations, and to the north a dim glowing smear could be seen, speckled at the edges with uncountable stars. The Path of Jewels, or Johor's River, as the Ossians still called it. When he was little, Aaron had looked up at Lissa and imagined his mother looking down on him. She'd been named Lissa too, and to a young mind that had profound significance. On nights when there was no moon, or on blood moon nights when Tantera took lone watch and painted the land red, he'd wake distressed in the small hours and scream for his father. His mother might not have been there to comfort him then, but his father was a rock, strong enough to cling to in a storm. Tonight that rock had fractured. He'd never thought of Randall as a person, only as a parent, a force of authority, not a fallible man. Randall had never shown him worry or weakness before, so Aaron had somehow assumed there was none to be found. Now, for the first time, he doubted him. He tried to dampen those thoughts. They scared him. His father was just tired, he told himself, but the memory of their conversation gnawed at him. Perhaps I thought you were the Hollow Man. You remember him, don't you? The Hollow Man. Aaron hadn't thought of him for years. A dead man who walked the land, searching for a soul to replace the one he'd lost. There was a great scar across his neck where his throat had been cut. If you ever see the Hollow Man, you run, Randall had told his terrified son once. You run and you don't stop, for he's come to kill you. Why had his father mentioned the Hollow Man tonight? Why, for that matter, had Randall tormented him with it at all? In all other ways he was so protective and warm, yet he'd given his son nightmares for weeks, and he'd done it more than once. Aaron distinctly remembered overhearing Nanny Crea, his first governess, complaining that Randall was frightening Aaron to death with nonsense. What had inspired such uncharacteristic malice? When he was older, Aaron had told Cade about the Hollow Man, and Cade had been fascinated. He'd never heard the legend, and he prided himself on collecting tales of shades and bogeymen. So Cade went to his mother, who seemed to know every tale ever told. But she'd not heard of the Hollow Man either. A group of giggling figures crossed the lane in front of him and went forging off through the long meadow grass. They were heading for the coves, where most of their friends would be gathering. Aaron was aiming for higher ground, where the tallest cliffs reared above the waves. He was heading for the watchtower. At last it came into sight, and in his excitement he forgot all about his father and the Hollow Man. It was a broken fang against the clifftops, lit from below and behind by pearly light, its ancient bricks mortared with shadow. Only the side that faced the sea still stood, narrow and alone, looking out to the west and the islands of the Ellaroo beyond the horizon. The rest of the tower had crumbled until it was little more than a ring of stones, barely higher than a man, surrounding grassy piles of rubble and the fragments of arched doorways. This wasn't the craft of old Ossia, the long-lost empire of his ancestors, but a poor copy, clawed from the ground in the brutal centuries that followed, when Ossia was driven back to ignorance, savagery, and war. He headed up the hill, following the overgrown road on the landward side, where stones laid in another age still rested in the dirt. As he neared, he spotted others slipping towards the ruin in the moonlight. He found at least 24 inside. Groups of friends drank wine and joked among themselves, while couples walked arm in arm through the tumbled remains, the stars bright above them. Despite their number and their high spirits, laughter was quiet and voices low. There was something forbidden about this place, something delicious and frightening that discouraged disturbance. Or perhaps it was simply the magic of the night that quieted them, and the plaintive cries coming from the sea. His eyes were covered from behind, and he felt a warm body press up against him. "Who could it be?" wondered a voice in his ear. "It can't be Sora," he replied with a smile. "She's such a good, obedient girl. Definitely not the sort to sneak from her home in the dead of night against her father's wishes." Sora gently nibbled his earlobe. "I have heard that love makes girls do the strangest things." Aaron had to suppress a shiver of delight. The heat of her breath against his cheek burned away his patience in an instant. "Let me see you then, if it really is Sora, and not some shade sent to torment me." The hands left his eyes and he turned. There she was, laughing in the moonlight with that look she had, half innocence and half mischief. The sight set off a cascade of joy that spread out from his chest, leaving him stunned, empowered, amazed. He was helpless before the force of first love. There had never been any girl like her in his life, and there never would be again. He knew, with dizzying certainty, that she was the one he was meant for, that he'd marry her and they'd spend their lives together. She was a Croden blonde, like her brother Harold, hair cut to the line of her jaw, with wide-set grey eyes in an open face that suited mirth and play, and a broad, toothy smile. Some distant part of him knew that she wasn't considered one of the great beauties of the Empire, not even the prettiest girl in Shoal Point, but that didn't matter to Aaron. In his eyes, she had no equal. For their rendezvous, she'd chosen a light, floaty dress of emerald green, now dirtied at the hem and entirely at odds with her stout walking boots. Elegant and practical, he marvelled at her cleverness. He reached for her, to bring her to him and kiss her, but she danced away, tut-tutting. "Where is your restraint, my wild Ossian boy? Kisses, is it? I thought you lured me from my bed to show me mysterious wonders." Aaron's grin was tinged with frustration. He wanted her lips against his, but she'd have her game first, her teasing and flirting. She'd make him wait. She'd said once that the chase made the catching all the sweeter, but all things being equal, Aaron would rather cut straight to the good part. "Well then," he said, holding out a hand, "will you walk with me, my lady? I hope you'll find the spectacle worth your while." "Why, he's a gentleman after all," she said, and laid her hand in his. Just the touch of her palm made his heart quicken. They ambled among the stones, making their way unhurriedly through the crumbling outlines of forgotten chambers. Walking with her hand in his, he felt a foot taller. That she should have chosen him, of all the boys of Shoal Point. Nobody appeared to be paying them particular attention, but he imagined secret envy and grudging respect in every glance that came their way. "They say this is where Carla of the Dawnwardens watched for the Ellaroo fleet coming from the sea," he said, eager to show off his knowledge. For once he didn't mind telling an Ossian tale. "King Angrid the Maimed had been told that the Ellaroo were preparing to invade, but he was bewitched by a silver-tongued Ellaroo ambassador who convinced him that the true danger came from the Harish to the north.
He sent his armies to the Harish border, but the Dawn Wardens knew better and set Carla here to watch. For 30 days and 30 nights she waited, and on the 30th day she saw the sails of the fleet just as the sun was setting. She took to her horse and rode non-stop night and day to Morgenholm to tell the king. The king realized his mistake and sent his armies to the coast. Everyone believed it was too late, but when they arrived, they found that the Dawn Wardens had raised all the local garrisons and held back a force of Eleru 10 times their number, keeping them pinned along the coast until reinforcements could arrive. The Eleru were driven back to their ships and fled, and the invasion failed. She clutched his arm. That's so exciting! Were the Dawn Wardens great heroes, then? They were an order of warriors, adventurers, and scholars who swore allegiance to the Ember Blade. Sometimes they acted as an elite royal guard, trusted with the most sensitive and dangerous missions. But they operated in secret, too, always looking to the good of the realm. Their true loyalty wasn't to any ruler, but to Ossia itself. He looked up at the seaward wall, rising above the ruins, strange white light glowing through its narrow stone windows. Yes, they were great heroes, back when we had any. Sora pursed her lips and frowned slightly, the way she did when she was thinking. Aaron found it unbearably charming, but then he found everything she did unbearably charming.
I have heard of the Ember Blade, she said uncertainly. You lost it when Ossia fell.
It was captured, Aaron said, by a Crodan general called Daken, and taken to Croda with the other spoils of conquest.
And what about the Dawn Wardens? Where were they?
There have been no records of their deeds for 200 years. They belonged to another time. They are nothing but stories now. She sniffed.
Petter says that when the Ember Blade was captured, the Ossians all gave up.
Aaron tensed at the mention of Petter, a Crodan boy altogether too sure of himself, who spent more time in Sora's company than Aaron would like.
That's true. But it's just a sword, she said, puzzled. Petter says the Crodan army would never surrender just because someone took a sword away.
Aaron was unable to keep the pout from his voice.
Well, he said, perhaps that's why you won. You're jealous, she teased.
He scowled.
Oh, don't be. Petter's a loudmouth.
You're the one I'll marry. If your father and brothers allow it, Aaron said sulkily. Just the mention of another boy had made him peevish and obtuse. You know Harald and Duke warned me off again today.
Ha! They barked at me too, she said, waving a hand. What a pair of sneaks, stealing a letter from their sister's room. How very mature of them.
She smiled at him wickedly.
But I'm the better sneak. They told me I couldn't go out tonight, but I slipped past them anyway.
They knew you were meeting me? Aaron asked in horror.
They suspected, but they didn't see me leave, and what they don't know won't hurt them. Oh, here are the stairs. Let's go up.
A set of precarious steps climbed the curved interior of the seaward wall. The stone was much eroded, and in places there were alarming gaps where a chunk had fallen away. Aaron, however, was less alarmed by the steps than by Sora's last comment. It was as if she didn't realize how serious this all was, or what might happen if they were caught. He was risking more than just a beating tonight. If Sora's father spoke with the governor, the consequences would fall on his father too, and he dreaded to think what they might be. He took her other hand and turned her to face him. Suddenly he needed to know if she was truly his, if she'd wait for him to return from the army. He wanted to spill his thoughts to her, confess all his insecurities and share his growing fear as he began to comprehend the enormity of the future bearing down on him. A year apart, unable to see or touch her. A year not knowing what she was doing or who she was doing it with. He'd avoided thinking about it for a long time. Ignoring difficult questions, Nanny Elsa had once said, was a particular talent of his.
but now he felt as if a terrifying void yawned at his feet. She saw it in his eyes and put a finger to his lips. He was a man, not a boy, she said with that gesture. This wasn't a night to be faint-hearted, not if he wanted his kisses. So he swallowed his fears, relieved and hurt all at once, and led the way up the stairs. The stairs were broken off part way up, ending in empty air and stars. To their left was a doorway which led onto a balcony that ran around the outer edge of the seaward wall. It was little more than a wide ledge chewed by the years, its parapets long fallen. Moonlit figures sat along its length, their legs dangling over the three-story drop to the turf below. They'd braved the heights for a view that stretched 15 leagues in every direction. From the watchtower, it was possible to see the whole spectacle. Aaron and Sora stepped out and joined them, and Sora's eyes widened as she saw the ghost tide for the first time. The very sea was aglow. All along the coast, strange aurorae curled and slid like slow ribbons beneath the waves. Where the water met the shore, in the coves and against the cliffs, the glow gathered to a blinding intensity. The docks were ablaze with it, rickety jetties and moored boats made dreamlike, floating in liquid white light. Further out were the hull whales, vast barnacled monsters, so encrusted they seemed more stone than flesh. They jetted clouds of water, rolled over with a splash of fins. Occasionally, one would surge up from below with its mouth agape, scattering the ribbons of light into tiny shreds. Then they'd crash down and sink, and there would be calm, and the ribbons would slowly reform. It was the whales that Aaron had heard on his journey here, great bass creaks deep enough to feel in the breastbone, strange irregular popping noises, eerie howls and screeches that set his nerves on edge. They were supernatural sounds that brought to mind the wild ancient places where things from the world of the dead were said to hold sway. No wonder the sailors of elder days thought the ghost tide was the spirits of the drowned dead returning to land, herded by Joha's whales. It was the hope of every Ossian to return to the earth when they died, where the agents of Sala, Lady of Worms, could break down their bodies and return them to the green cycle of life. Those who went to sea prayed to the Heron King, aspect of sea and sky, to deliver them back to Sala if they should sink. The ghost tide was proof that their prayers were heeded. Aaron didn't believe in the Nine, in Sala or Joha or any of the rest. He followed the light of the Primus and scoffed at the ignorance of his forefathers. But standing here, faced with this inexplicable majesty, it was hard not to feel the spirits of the old world reaching out to him, or the gods of his homeland like tall shadows at his back. He turned to Sora, intending to remark on the view, but the words died in his throat as he saw the tears in her eyes. She reached out, took his face in her cupped hands, and brought his lips to hers at last. 10. Diligence, temperance, dominance. The credo of the Sanctorum. Aaron gazed across the classroom at the plaque above the blackboard. Diligence, temperance, dominance. Persistence and self-control led to victory. If only it were that simple with girls. The master's voice had become a background drone to the turmoil in his tired mind. The board was covered with letters and numbers and lines, but Aaron had lost their meaning. He tried to pay attention, but his thoughts kept skating away. It had been 3 nights since the ghost tide began. 3 nights in which he'd hardly slept, and when he did, he woke violently, his heart pounding. Once he dreamed the Hollow Man entered his room and stood next to his bed while he lay paralyzed. The Hollow Man tipped his head back
and the scar at his throat parted like a wet red mouth. Aaron had jerked awake, whimpering like a puppy. There had been no word from Sora, and no sign of her in town. The silence worried him. Had he offended her somehow? Had she fallen ill, perhaps? Had her brothers found out about that night? He blinked the thought away for the 100th time. Concentrate, he told himself, and focused on the blackboard again, where Master Bilk was pointing his rod at an equation. He was a short, plump Croden with huge bushy eyebrows and tufts of grey hair that stuck out over his ears, giving him the appearance of an angry owl. The other dozen students were dutifully scratching on their slates. Aaron made a half-hearted attempt to look busy, but he found his gaze drifting back to the credo again. Diligence, temperance, dominance. Everything had changed when the ghost tide arrived. His father had been a new man in the morning, as he promised, and for the last few days he'd been as warm and attentive as ever. But Aaron wasn't fooled. It all felt false now, all of it a front. Uncertainty had spread through him, causing him to question things he'd never questioned before. Sora, for example. His night with Sora had been everything he wanted. She was dazzled by the ghost tide, and their time together had been full of kisses and professions of desire. Yet, after they parted, he was plagued with doubt. They talked of love, marriage, and children, but never of concerns, fears, or problems. He wanted to know how they'd overcome her family's opposition to their union. He wanted to make plans for their year apart. But somehow it was never the right time to talk about the difficult realities of their relationship. Somehow she made it that way. He was beginning to wonder if Sora was taking all this as seriously as he was. The idea threatened him with such torment that he hardly dared think it. Aaron? Master Bilk's voice jolted him back to the moment. With sudden horror, he realized that an answer was expected of him, but he didn't know the question. The other boys turned towards him one by one as the silence stretched out. "Well, stand up," said the master. Aaron shot to his feet, grateful for a task he could accomplish. Master Bilk tapped his rod against an equation on the blackboard. "Solve for B, please." Blood flooded Aaron's face as he stared witlessly at the blackboard. He was lost, and everyone in the room knew it. Some of the students smirked. Others wore pity on their faces. He didn't know which was worse. "Come along," barked Master Bilk. "I've just told you how to do it." Aaron's mouth was dry. He swallowed, opened it, shut it again. "Master Bilk, I..." he began, and was saved when the door to the classroom burst open, and there was Cade, of all people, sweaty and panting. Aaron had never been so pleased to see him. "How dare you, boy!" Master Bilk roared, with a face like he was about to expel a pellet. "Get out of my classroom!" Cade didn't even glance at him. His eyes found Aaron's, and they were full of fright. "You have to come!" he gasped. "They've arrested your da!" The world closed in on Aaron, and the heat of humiliation cooled to icy shock. The master, the other students, even Cade, faded away to insignificance as the meaning of those words sank in. He scrambled out from behind his desk, fled the classroom, and ran for home. He remembered little of the journey back. It was as if he'd entered a tunnel, and outside was nothing but a hazy blur, strange noises, shapes without form. All he knew was the motion of his body, the pain in his muscles as he sprinted through streets and down lanes. At one point, he might have heard Cade calling his name as he laboured in pursuit, but there was no question of slowing down for him. His mind was a blare of senseless panic and disbelief. It couldn't be. It wasn't real. If he could get home, somehow he could sort this out, make it right. He just had to get home. There were a dozen townsfolk gathered outside the house when he arrived, Croden and Ossian both, drawn by neighbourly concern or ghoulish curiosity. They parted for him as he pelted up the drive from the road. Waiting by the front steps was a black carriage
drawn by 4 black horses, with a double-barred cross on the side, the sign of the Iron Hand, the Emperor's most feared investigators. His steps faltered, and he stumbled to a halt before it, blanching with dread. The Iron Hand didn't trouble themselves with minor felonies or local squabbles. They dealt with threats to the Empire. When the Iron Hand took someone away, they didn't come back. A Crodan woman reached out as if to comfort him. Her husband pulled her back, his eyes cold, his expression detached. If the father was an enemy of the Empire, then what of the son? Better to be safe than to be tainted by association. At that, Aaron gritted his teeth and straightened his spine. Curse them all, then. Curse the faithless who thought his father condemned. They'd be ashamed when this was over, when this misunderstanding was cleared up and justice was done. Randil was a good man and loyal to the Empire. That was as true as the moons in the sky. Whatever had happened here, he was sure his father had done nothing to invite the wrath of the Iron Hand. But maybe he had. He dared not follow that thought to its end. Clutching his ribs where a stitch jabbed him, he lurched past the onlookers, up the steps to the porch and inside. Nanny Alsa was among the servants gathered fearfully in the corridor. She tried to stop him going into the dining room, but he threw her arm off and pushed past, almost falling through the doorway. Rough hands caught him, and he was hoisted to his feet by a man wearing the livery of the Iron Guard, the soldiers of the Iron Hand. "And you must be Aaron," said a small, bespectacled man with moist, fleshy lips, in a tone of weary disdain. He wore the long black overcoat and the double-barred cross of a watchman, one of the Emperor's inquisitors. Aaron struggled in the soldier's grip, but he was held fast. The room was busy with armoured men. There was another watchman wearing an identical overcoat, who was otherwise the opposite of his companion, tall and blonde, with stern, well-proportioned features and a swimmer's shoulders. At the centre of it all was his father, grey-faced, manacled, resigned. He had the look of a man who'd arrived at his own grave. "It's a mistake! He hasn't done anything!" Aaron shouted, unable to understand why his father had submitted to this treatment. "Get off me!" He pulled an arm free of the guardsman who held him, and was rewarded with a clout round the head, hard enough to rock him. Before he could recover, a second guardsman restrained him, and he was held fast. "Clisson, leave him be!" Randall cried, roused to anger by the sight. "He's no part of this!" Clisson, the first of the two officers, studied Aaron with reptilian calm. "Thank you for coming, boy. You have saved us the trouble of finding you." He motioned to one of the soldiers. "Take him." "No," Randall snapped, desperation in his voice. "Your business is with me, not him."
"You are a traitor, and he is the son of a traitor," Clisson said coldly. "He will be dealt with accordingly."
He waved at the other watchman.
"Hart, go with them."
The guardsmen began dragging Aaron out of the room.
"Father!"
he screamed, and the sound jolted Randall to action. His eyes hardened. He twisted, and suddenly there was a knife in his manacled hands, stolen from the sheath of a nearby soldier. Quick as a snake, he plunged it into the throat of the man he'd taken it from. Before anyone could react, he spun and slashed the face of another, opening his cheek to the bone. Then everything was chaos. The crash of armour and the ring of drawn blades, as the soldiers holding Aaron dropped him to the floor and piled in. Aaron landed hard, knocking the wind from him, and he struggled to his elbows, gasping. A guardsman reeled back from the fight, a hand to his face, blood seeping through his glove. Nanny Alsa was shrieking out in the corridor. Clisson, alarmed by the unexpected violence, shrank against the wall of the dining room, keeping well clear. Aaron saw a blade flicker, and another Crodan soldier staggered away, clutching his throat, blood soaking his uniform. For an instant, he was the Hollow Man,
a vision of gargling death come to claim him. Then he crashed against the dining room table and collapsed. All at once, the tangle of soldiers parted, and Randall was hauled to his feet by Hart, with the point of a knife pressed firmly under his jaw. The watchman stood close behind Randall, his hair mussed and his teeth bared from the savagery of the fight. Guardsmen seized Randall's arms, but he'd lost his weapon now and wasn't resisting any more.
"You are a traitor to the Empire and a murderer," Hart said.
He looked at Clisson, his eyes glittering with defiance.
"Under the circumstances, I think we can skip the trial."
With that, he drove the knife home. Aaron saw the light in his father's eyes go out. Randall sighed, one long breath that carried his life with it, and he dropped in a pile of meat and bone at Hart's feet. Aaron screamed. He was still screaming as they dragged him down the corridor, hurling curses and fighting the whole way. They struck him across the face more than once, but it did nothing to quiet him. Nothing they could do was worse than what had already happened.
"Get off him! You're killing him! Get off!"
It was Cade, angry and sweaty and out of breath, as he shoved down the corridor past the servants. That broad face loomed in his vision, his cheeks red and his hair damp against his forehead.
"Aaron, what happened? Where are they taking you?"
Aaron stared at him without comprehension. His words were just noises. In the shock of Randall's death, nothing connected.
"Out of the way, vermin," snapped one of the guardsmen.
The ostler grabbed Cade by the arm and tried to pull him aside, but Cade's feet were set and he was rooted like a tree.
"You can't take him,"
Cade cried, but he was yelling in Ossian and the soldier was yelling in Croden, and in the heat of the moment neither understood the other.
"Out of the way, I said."
"He's done nothing wrong,"
Cade shouted. His protests were cut short as a guardsman slammed the pommel of a sword down on his head behind his ear, and he crumpled like a sack. Aaron heard Clisson's wet voice from close behind him.
"Interfering with an overwatchman of the Iron Hand is a crime," he said, for the benefit of the witnesses. "Take him to..."
Aaron tried to look over his shoulder as he was dragged out, but he couldn't see his friend as he was hauled onto the porch. The crowd numbered 36 or more now. They stared in silence as he was manhandled down the steps, tears and snot and blood across his face, rage and grief written there. Then he saw her, and he knew that what he suspected all along was true, why the Iron Hand were here, why his father had died. Sora was in the crowd, hands to her face in horror. Standing with her were her brothers and her father, a hawkish man with a stony expression. Her trip to the watchtower had been discovered. Her father had spoken to the governor about the impertinent Ossian boy who was harassing her, and how Randall had failed to control him. They'd trumped up a charge of treason to remove the problem. Suspicion was enough to seize their lands. Even a man as rich as Randall could do nothing about it. They were only Ossians, after all. "No more warnings," Harald had said, but in the arrogance of love he hadn't listened. The soldiers shoved him inside the black carriage and tipped Cade in alongside him, unconscious, blood splayed across his cheek like a spidery red hand.
"No,"
he whimpered. He shook his head and kept shaking it, his eyes fixed on Cade.
"No, no, no."
But all the denials in the world couldn't dent the truth. The enormity of what he'd done threatened to swallow him whole. It was his fault. All of it. The door of the prison carriage slammed closed behind him, with a sound like the doom of all dreams. 11. Dusk lay red on the hills as the druidess laboured up the grassy rise, her hound loping at her heels. She walked with a splintered staff of lichwood and lightning glass, planting it in the ground before her, but she was not old, and her legs were strong from the passage of many leagues.
She wore sturdy boots and scuffed leather trousers. A tatty patchwork cloak made of the stitched-together skins of rabbit, fox and stoat flapped about her as she climbed. She clicked and clattered with charms of bone and wood and metal, and carried a great pack as if it were no weight at all. Her hair was long, black and filthy, falling to either side of an oval face with dark eyes and a serious mouth that turned down at the edges, lending her an air of intensity and purpose. That face was smeared with streaks of stark white and coal black, as if for camouflage or for war. Her name was Vika Walks the Barrows, and she was late. The journey had been long, and unforeseen diversions had delayed her arrival, Crodans chief among them. They delved deeper into the wild places than ever before. Once they could have been relied upon to stay near roads and cities, clinging to the apparatus of order like fearful children to a mother's apron. They were lost without their rules and routines, and shied away from nature, which didn't respect their laws. But they'd become bolder in recent years, and she'd encountered them several times on her way through the hinterlands, camps of engineers plotting new roads, workmen building settlements, surveyors scouting for minerals to exploit and forests to log. Her lip curled in anger at the memory. Near Salt Fork, she'd unwittingly walked into the path of the Crodan army, marching to quell the rebellion. She'd been forced to hide out for days, moving from place to place while the forests swarmed with scouts and foragers gathering supplies. After the rebellion collapsed, huntsmen were unleashed to seek out fugitives. With them came something else, something that the forest itself recoiled from. Three beings that wore the shape of men, but which were not. They almost caught her as she sheltered in an abandoned temple, but the animals warned her of their approach, and she fled, leaving her fire behind. Later, she glimpsed them through the trees, one an enormous pile of tarnished black armour with a great hammer in his hands, one ragged and thin, carrying a brutal-looking bow that was all spikes and points, the third cowled and moving like a whisper, with two thin blades in his gloved grip and a metal mask covering his face. The mere sight of them turned her cold, and she stayed well clear. It wasn't her they hunted, thankfully. Their targets were two fugitives from Salt Fork. She didn't linger to see what happened to them, but she doubted the outcome was good. Instead, she was forced to hurry on, through forests still thick with Crodans. At one point, the huntsmen picked up her trail, perhaps believing her a fugitive like the others. It took every trick she knew to throw them off, but she knew a lot of tricks. Now, at long last, they'd reached their destination. Too eager to wait, her companion hurried off through the bracken and gorse towards the crest of the rise. She was a shaggy grey wolfhound bitch named Ruck, longer nose to tail than Vika was tall. Vika followed in her wake, full of grave thoughts. Maggot's Eve had come and gone 5 nights since. She hoped Haggath had waited for her, though it was a faint hope at best. Too many meetings had been missed these past years. News wasn't travelling as it should. Now, more than ever, it was important the communion be maintained. But she feared the druids' habitual solitude would be their undoing. Every year there were fewer of them. Everywhere she went, temples were left to ruin and sacred sites abandoned. It was rare to encounter fresh druid sign, and when she did it spoke of ill things, of restless, angry spirits, and turmoil in the Shadowlands. The Primus grew in strength as the aspects waned. Yet still her gods were silent. The elders had to act. A conclave must be called. But she'd heard nothing. Perhaps Haggath would have news to cheer her. At the least, he'd have left Druid sign to indicate his next destination, so Vika could catch him up.
She was in sore need of company and hope. But hope crumbled to ashes in her breast as she reached the rise where Ruck waited and saw what lay beyond. Before her lay a wide hollow, a dent in the hilltop flanked by steep rising slopes and backed by a cliff. She stood at its eastern edge, with the rolling hills behind her and the long shadows of dusk upon them. The sun, weak and low amid thin layered clouds of gold and blood, was just visible above the cliff. Warm light glowed along the rim, but the hollow lay in a summer twilight. It was called the Dirracum, Chern Anun in the tongue of the Druids, and it was said that the first humans, descended from the giants of old, paid fealty to the Nine here in thanks for seeing them through the long ice to the spring. They raised 10 great stones in worship, one for the Creator and one for each of the pieces into which he broke himself when he birthed the universe, the 9 aspects, each an individual, yet each a part of the same being, 9 sides of the same unknowable God. Those stones had stood through the mysterious millennia before written history, which men called the Age of Legends. They'd endured the rise and fall of empires, keeping silent watch as the land suffered cataclysm and barbarity and emerged from the ruins forged anew. But they didn't stand now. After more lifetimes than Vika could imagine, the 10 pillars lay toppled. Ruck whined at her side as she stared, horrified. When she'd last visited, 3 years ago, the pillars stood proud and grim along the shore of a kidney-shaped tarn, a small mountain lake like a mirror turned to the sky. The tallest, carved for the Creator, had stood in the lake itself. Its shadow reached across the water every dawn, touching each aspect in turn as the year ran its course, like a giant sundial. Now that pillar was a broken stump, poking from water grown thick with weeds. The other aspects lay in pieces, shattered where they fell, hidden among the heather, bramble, and vine that sprouted unchecked around them. 3 short years, and the Dirracum had fallen. Nobody tended it now. No pilgrims came any more. It was already being reclaimed by the earth. How had she not heard of this outrage? Dazed, she walked into the hollow, Ruck trotting uncertainly at her side. The pillars had been weathered by the years, and the gods were mere bumps and grooves hinting at form. Yet there was still a sense of them, their presence heavy in the air. There was half of a snarling face that had to belong to the despoiler, Azra aspect of war. Nearby was the voluptuous Earth Mother, stone-skinned Meshuk, aspect of earth and fire. They'd existed so long, she'd thought them eternal. Now she was no longer sure.
"How could you let this happen?" she asked the aspects. "Why did you allow it?"
But the aspects, as ever, kept their own counsel. She scanned the hollow for signs of Haggath, but if he'd been here, he hadn't lingered. Ruck sniffed at something in the grass, raised her head, and gave a sharp bark. Vika drifted over, still stunned by the force of the blasphemy surrounding her. She knelt down and picked up the coin Ruck had found in the dirt. It was a Crodan guilder. On one side was a vertical sword laid across an open book. On the other, the likeness of the Emperor in profile. She scraped the dirt from the Emperor's face with one cracked thumbnail and looked down at him. It was proof enough for her, if proof were needed. The stones had been pulled down, destroyed with forethought and purpose, at the order of the Sanctorum.
"They are erasing us," she thought.
She dropped the coin and walked to the shore of the tarn. It was summer, and warm even in the shade cast by the cliff, but she pulled her cloak about her nevertheless. Ruck hung back, sensing her mood, as she looked down into the water.
A painted face returned her haunted gaze.
It's true, then, what the apostates said. Our gods have abandoned us. This land is forsaken.
The fire crackled and snapped at the edge of the tarn, its flames reflected in the black water. Vika sat cross-legged before it, eyes closed, Ruck slumbering nearby. On the ground near the fire was a small black pot, from which wisps of steam arose. Night had fallen beyond the circle of light, and the sky was sprayed with stars. She had been still for an hour or more before a rat grew bold enough to investigate her. It slipped along the water's edge, sniffing the air, drawn by the intriguing smells from the pot. Keeping the fire between itself and the wolfhound, whom it recognized as an enemy, it scurried through the dark and into the shadow of Vika's knee. Her hand shot out, and she snatched it up by its throat. Lifting it quickly, she held it before her eyes, its paws scratching the air.
"Thank you, little one," she said, and broke its neck with one quick twist.
Ruck raised her head and watched with mild interest as Vika slit the rat's throat with her knife and drained its blood into the pot. As it trickled out, she muttered prayers of gratitude to Og, Aspect of Beasts, and paid her respects to the little animal that had given the gift of its life. When there was no more blood to be had, she tossed the body to Ruck, pulled back her sleeve, and drew the edge of her blade along her skin among dozens of old scars. She let a few drops of her blood run into the pot, then wrapped a rag around the cut. Swirling the pot to mix it, she bowed her head and murmured ancient words in stone speak before drinking the bitter, salty draught. That done, she settled herself again, cross-legged, eyes closed. Ruck snorted, crunched down her rat, and fell asleep.
"Who is here?" Vika asked in her mind.
She'd searched the site for druid sign, but found none. Haggath hadn't been here, and it was too much to hope that he'd also been delayed. Haggath was the most reliable of her contacts. That left two possibilities. He was dead, or he'd been arrested, which amounted to the same thing. Haggath was lost, like so many of her brothers and sisters in faith. One more broken link in the faltering communion. She couldn't keep on like this. She couldn't stand idly by and watch the sacred places fall into ruin, her gods driven into myth. So she'd ask for guidance, the best way she knew how. She'd call on the spirits of this place, which had once been mighty, and see what wisdom they could offer. The concoction seeped through her body, from her belly to her fingertips and teeth, through muscle and nerve, loosening her wherever it went. There was an acrid taste of metal in her mouth, and a burning in her gut as her senses sharpened. She smelled Ruck strongly, the musky aliveness of her. Her sleeping sighs were loud in Vika's ears. From the lake came the odour of weedy rot, and the dry hot scent of burning wood drifted from the grumbling fire. Soon she began to feel jittery, and her joints started to ache as the poisons in the drink made themselves felt. She opened her eyes, stood, and looked up to the sky. Above the hollow, Sebastra's ribbon was a faint, curling cloud of red and yellow, the only colour in the blackness. She took a breath, sucking the darkness into her lungs like water, and wobbled as she lost her balance. The stars wheeled overhead, blurring as they spun. She threw out her arms to stabilize herself. The concoction was powerful stuff, powerful enough to kill someone who hadn't spent years developing their resistance to its toxins. Once steady, she looked up to the sky once more, trying to recapture her calm. But the stars were not where they'd been. She frowned. Sebastra's ribbon had been overhead a moment ago, but now it was some way to the south. New constellations had moved into view. The gull was all but gone,
and the fox had taken its place on the eastern horizon. The sisters had appeared at half-moon, Tantera cracked and massive, pale Lissa peering out from behind her. A moment ago it had been summer. Now she stood beneath autumn stars. So it had begun. The spirits were guiding her. But what did it mean? Something moved at the edge of her vision, a curling wisp of light, as if a tongue of flame had escaped the fire and was being blown around the broken pillars. She turned, but it was lost among the tumbled stones and thick grass. Intrigued, she set off to investigate. As she went, she passed before a fragment of a god's face, lying on its side. The shadows shifted in the pit of its sunken eye, as if it had moved to follow her, and she felt a faint tingle, the presence of a stirring spirit. "Show yourself." The fallen pillars formed a maze of shattered blocks taller than she was. She hunted through the sedge and bracken between the aspects. Again and again, she glimpsed the light at the edge of her vision and allowed it to lead her on, but at last she lost sight of it and came to a stop. She searched the hollow uncertainly, afraid that she'd missed whatever message had been offered. Suddenly she heard something move. "Behind me." She whirled with a gasp, the charms in her hair and clothes clacking together, and her face was lit up by the figure standing there. It was a tall being of flurrying brightness, sparkling and shifting like sunlight on disturbed water. In its hand was a sword which burned fierce enough to blind. She shaded her eyes. "What message do you have for me?" she cried. The figure didn't speak, or move, or acknowledge her, but it emanated strength, and she knew in the way of visions that it was an ally, a champion of the land. "Are you come from the Aspects? Have they answered the prayers of their people at last?" The champion gave her no reply, so she narrowed her eyes and peered closer. Beneath the glimmering, turning light, she could see a hint of a face. If only she could make it out, she'd know the nature of this herald. Tentatively, she extended a hand as if to touch its cheek, to feel its features like a blind woman. The instant her fingertips touched it, it vanished like a blown-out candle, and something thumped to the earth at her feet. She blinked, surprised. Her night vision was ruined, so she knelt down and patted in the dark grass until her hands closed around what had fallen. It was cool, smooth, and sharp. The sword, surely. Yet when she stood and lifted it from the grass, it was nothing more than a crooked branch. She frowned at it in puzzlement. The bright figure was gone, and the hollow had become chilly, the starlight steely and cold. She chewed at her lower lip and scanned her surroundings, searching for another sign. What were the spirits trying to tell her? She looked down again and found she was no longer holding a branch, but an oozing rod of bone and gristle, the long, scrawny forelimb of some creature she didn't recognize. With a cry of disgust, she cast it away, and as it fell, it became a black snake that